Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
This GX on Agriculture podcast is brought to you by Haas Nissan in Yorkton.
To the people tending the land and animals that feed us and support our community, we at Haas Nissan want to say thank you on behalf of all those who depend on you, the farmer. Like you, we're a family business with family values you can depend on. Haas Nissan, where a customer becomes family.
GX on Agriculture with Doug Falconer.
Good afternoon and welcome to GX on Agriculture. Coming up on today's program, grain markets are mainly trending downward this week. We'll find out why from Adam Piccolo, who is a commodity futures advisor with PI Financial. As well, infringing on plant breeders' rights has cost a large southern Alberta farm a record $737,597. We'll hear from Todd Hira, the Western Business Manager for CCAN, about that settlement. The president of the Saskatchewan Stock Growers Association is calling this week's fundraising auction a huge success. We'll hear from Kelsey Elford of Cairnport. As well, taxes on unhealthy foods containing large amounts of sugar and salt could be one of the trends coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll hear from David Hughes, who is a professor emeritus of food marketing at Imperial College in London, England. All that and much more coming up on today's edition of GX in Agriculture. But first, it's time for the Agriculture Outlook with Precision Weather. And that's a presentation of Sean Prahitka, your REMAX Blue Chip Ag Division Specialist.
Agriculture Outlook with Precision Weather.
With Phil Spivak from Precision Weather. And Phil, as we head into the weekend, what sort of weather can we expect?
Well, it's not going to be as warm as we've, I don't want to say come to expect, because you know, you don't expect it this time of year, but we've come to see of late. It is going to be dropping through the afternoon. We're heading in a downward direction. We'll be at our coolest, though, tomorrow. And actually, Sunday does feature a little snow, does feature temperatures below normal, but all in all, not awful. We're down to 12 through the afternoon. The wind is up, north to northeast, 15 to 30. That's putting the wind chill as the temperature falls down through the minus teens and into the minus 20s. So certainly the wind chill next, we'll say 24, maybe 36 hours is going to be fairly, again, I don't want to say it's unusual. It's going to be colder than we've seen in a couple days. But minus 20s by this afternoon for the wind chill. The wind chill near minus 30 tonight. The actual temperature falls to minus 21. Winds north to northeast in the 15 to 25, maybe still 30 in the evening, and then starting to drop off a bit. A little light snow coming in, though, for tonight could be a couple of centimeters, and then that light snow tapers off through the day tomorrow. We're only at minus 16. Wind turns back into the southwest. We'll have a little bit of a warm-up as we climb from minus 16 on Saturday. We dropped to minus 22, then climbed back to minus 11 on Sunday. As I mentioned, a little below normal, but only a little. Not high this time of year, minus 6. So we're just a few degrees down. Snow coming in may produce another centimeter or so around midday Sunday, it looks like. That's our best chance. But the warm air is going to be setting up. It'll start to move in through the day on Sunday. The temperature at night doesn't drop off all that much, and we make a pretty good run at freezing on Monday. Partly sunny sky with a high near minus 2, and we'll likely crack freezing on Tuesday. Mostly sunny with a high near plus 2.
That's Phil Spivak from Precision Weather. Temperatures around the region this hour, the Paw is at minus 23 degrees, Swan River minus 17, Dauphin minus 10, Brandon 0, Show Lake Russell and Roblin minus 3. Regina is at minus 3, Saskatoon minus 11, Hudson Bay minus 18, Broadview Mooseman minus 1, Indian Head minus 2, Wynyard Wadena Kelvington minus 12. The Yorkton-Melville region has some very light snow falling, but the sun is trying to shine through. It's a north wind at 21 kilometers an hour. 81% is the relative humidity. The temperature is minus 6 degrees. With the wind chill, it feels more like minus 12 degrees. Yesterday, Yorkton reached a high of plus 1 degree and dropped to a low of minus 12 degrees. There was no precipitation recorded in the 24-hour period ending at midnight last night. The normal high for this date is minus 6. The normal low is minus 17. The sun rose in Yorkton at 7:41 this morning, and it will set at 6:25 tonight. Extreme temperatures for Manitoba and Saskatchewan yesterday. The Manitoba hotspot was Morden at plus 4 degrees, the cold spot to Dooley Lake at minus 38 degrees. The Saskatchewan hotspot was Maple Creek at plus 4 degrees, the cold spot Stony Rapids at minus 37 degrees. And that's a look at your agriculture weather. It's time to check in once again with Danny Ismond.
1-866-729-3478 is the number to come.
Welcome back to GX on Agriculture. Grain markets are mainly trending down this week. Commodity futures advisor with PI Financial, Adam Piccolo, says wheat is up 1 cent a bushel for the week, but canola has dropped from $10 to $57 per metric ton.
Starting off on the canola front, been a bit of a volatile week here with the March contract expiring. So in the last 3 days, the May contract, so now the nearby here, is down about $57 a ton. So quite volatile here recently. Now, however, on the week, though, May canola is only down about $10 a ton. So that just really kind of shows here how much of an increase we've seen on the canola front. And moving on to wheat, we've seen Minneapolis wheat fairly unchanged for the week now, approximately higher by only 1 cent on the week given on the May contract.
So what are the factors behind these market changes for both canola and wheat?
Well, starting off on the canola front, definitely because of the March contract expiring, there has been some movement there now going on to the May, and that's been kind of one main factor here, as well as really how overpriced canola really was relative to the soy markets. So now that we are actually seeing some of the soy markets decline, in particular soybean oil, soybeans and the soy meal. Actually, China soy meal futures slid nearly 5% overnight, and that was the sharpest decline on the meal in 8 years. So there's been, you know, it's some kind of movements on a few fronts that have, I think, caused now traders to reevaluate where canola prices are at these levels. Now, again, the market is overbought on the soy side of things, so there can be the short-term, you know, technical correction. However, the fundamentals still support, I would say, you know, the soy markets as well as canola to stay, you know, at higher longer term. Everybody, a lot of my farms I talk to, again, specials out there for close to $18 a ton before. So I think that, you know, the supply isn't there. Now, could canola correct another $20 a ton? You know, that could easily happen.
So what's the outlook for next week and beyond?
Looking for next week, again, here on the Friday, the trend has turned lower here on the canola front. And, you know, you probably haven't heard me say that very, very often here in the last few months, but the trend is lower here right now on the short term. Long term picture, I think it can still go back to where it was. On the wheat front here, there has been some weak technical action, and really there's a lack of kind of major weather issues because everybody heard about that cold weather in the States, you know, drove up the price there, and now kind of we are seeing it back off a little bit here. So I'm going to be watching for the wheat market to possibly weaken a little bit next week, maybe hold some of these levels I'm watching, but overall it seems that there might be some profit taking.
Adam Piccolo is a commodity futures advisor with PI Financial in Regina. It's coming up on 12:30 on GX and Agriculture. That means it's time for the AgriView portion of our program, and that's a presentation of Peebles Machine and Welding in Yorkton.
To the people tending the land and animals that feed us and support our community, we at Haas Nissan want to say thank you on behalf of all those who depend on you, the farmer. Like you, we're a family business with family values you can depend on. Haas Nissan, where a customer becomes family.
GX94, AgriView.
Manitoba is forecasting a low risk for major spring flooding in the southern and central parts of the province. Infrastructure Minister Ron Schuler says it still depends on weather conditions from now until the spring melt, but the province is ready to respond if needed. The province's Hydrologic Forecast Center reports below normal soil moisture at freeze-up, and winter precipitation has been normal to well below normal in the south and central areas. The center also predicts the risk of high water this spring is low to moderate in the north. Pulse Canada wants the federal government to be proactive in preventing a strike at the Port of Montreal later next month. A 10-day strike last summer ended with a tentative agreement on a 7-month truce, which is slated to end on March 20th. Greg Northey is Vice President of Corporate Affairs with Pulse Canada.
We are keenly aware that the strike that happened last August only ended because a truce was put in place, essentially for the two parties to negotiate a contract. That truce ends March 20th, and negotiations still haven't come to a conclusion. So when we talk about shocks to the system and fragility, this is often an area that causes some real problems for supply chains. Close to 1 million tons of containerized grain goes through Montreal, and the strike will directly impact that and prevent it from being exported. So definitely something we have our eye on.
Last year, the Port of Montreal exported containers of grain valued at more than $880 million. Negotiations mediated by the federal government have broken off. Pulse Canada wants Labor Minister Filomeno Tassi to get the two sides back to the table. There are reports that Canadian customers are already asking exporters to start making other arrangements to get their orders filled. The Maritime Employers Association is not commenting on negotiations, but says it's still confident a settlement can be reached by March 20th. Canadian farmers reaped record profits last year and are on track to do the same this year as prices for its top crops soared. Prices of canola hit all-time highs this month, rallying with oilseed rival soybeans on brisk Chinese buying to produce feed for that country's rebuilding hog herd. Farm exports in general were stronger last year. The record profits come despite disruptions to beef and pork production, as COVID-19 infections forced plants to suspend processing, leading to a backlog of livestock and lower prices. Allimel, one of Canada's biggest hog packers, recently temporarily closed its Red Deer, Alberta plant, forcing it to send some pigs to the U.S. Farmers' net cash income, a measure of profitability, jumped 21.8% in 2020 from the previous year to $16.5 billion, driven by increased sales value of the main field crops. Net cash income looks to climb another 6.8% this year to $17.6 billion. Livestock sales dipped 1.9% last year, and the horticulture industry also struggled. Demand for Canadian barley has surged with key buyer China in a trade dispute with usual supplier Australia. Spring wheat, another principal Canadian crop, is trading near more than three-year highs. There were few notable changes in the latest monthly supply and demand report from the International Grains Council yesterday. One of the more significant alterations was its 1.42% increase to total global production from that in 2019-20 at nearly 2.216 billion metric tons. It also raises its estimate for this year's marketing year's production by 6 million metric tons from its figure in January. The council cited improved production of wheat and coarse grains in Australia, Kazakhstan, and Russia for the increases. Also, it noted higher prices should lead to more corn grown in 2021. Total ending stocks remained the same as last month in the IGC report at 611 million metric tons, which is a drop of almost 1% from those in 2019-20. Global wheat production was pushed up 5 million metric tons from January to 773 million metric tons, according to the council, a 1.4% rise from production in the previous marketing year. The council held ending stocks at January's estimate of 294 million metric tons, 5.76% more than in 2019-2020. The IGC nudged up global corn production by 1 million metric tons from last month's report at 1.134 billion metric tons, a 0.8% increase from 2019-2020. The council also held its forecast on corn ending stocks at 294 million metric tons, up 5.76% from 2019-2020. Global soybean output was revised slightly from 359 million metric tons in January to 360 million in the IGC's February report. The council kept ending stocks at 45 million metric tons, an 11.76% decline from the previous marketing year. The London-based IGC is scheduled to issue its next supply and demand estimates on March 25th. And that's the Ag Review portion of our program. Let's head back out once again to Danny Ismond.
Well, we have your ticket waiting for you at 1-866-729-3478 with the Willabunch Golf Club Auto.
Welcome back to GX on Agriculture. I'm Doug Faulkner. There's some very light snow in the Yorkton-Melville area right now, and minus 6 degrees. I'll have your complete weather details coming up at 1 o'clock. Infringing on plant breeders' rights has cost a large southern Alberta farm a record $737,597. The settlement relates to unauthorized advertisements and sales of plant breeders' rights-protected barley and wheat varieties. Todd Hira, the Western Business Manager for CCAN, provides background on the settlement.
CCAN and Alliance Seed, plus one other seed company, pursued an infringer who had been selling protected wheat and barley over a number of years, and was good to get this one put to rest because it was a significantly large settlement, and it was $737,000 that would cover off the royalty as well as legal and investigative costs involved in this particular case. It took us 5 years from the initial report, just going through the legal process, working through lawyers back and forth, and the time frame for the illegal seed sales covers 6 years.
Hira says the financial end of the case was significant and the most important part of the dispute.
Because it really points out the magnitude of loss to a breeding program when somebody is profiting from selling protected varieties and not paying their way. And so this one really sets out front and center just how much money can be taken away from a breeding program. And so if we want to have access to the best genetics in the world, we need to be able to play by the rules and pay our share. And so this really exemplifies the importance of that.
Hira says talking about this settlement is a way to continue the education process. He says anyone selling seed illegally needs to take note of the possible repercussions. That applies to businesses and farmers.
And I think we've done a very good job over the last several years of creating awareness around plant breeders' rights and its importance in encouraging plant breeding. And this release is part of that education process. It's not something that we take lightly or enjoy doing, but it's a necessity to let people know that we're out there, we're watching, and we will take those to task that are infringing. It's also important to note that under the new rule, PBR 91, that took effect in 2015, it's not just the seller that can be taken to task. It can be the purchaser or the processor as well. And so under PBR 91, if a farmer buys seed from an illegal seller and then multiplies it over years, the farmer himself can be taken to task for royalty. So it's important to understand the varieties you're buying, understand the rules associated with those, and really keep them in mind.
The farm, which hasn't been identified, bought protected varieties and then chose to resell them as seed. It also provided custom seeding services using protected varieties. It's now 12:42 on GX and Agriculture.
Livestock market conditions.
U.S. live cattle futures for April are trading at 120.30. That's down 137. June live cattle trading at 118.62, down 87. April feeder cattle trading at 142.67, down 240. May feeder cattle trading at 145.35, down 187. April lean hogs trading at 87.55, down 220. May lean hogs trading at 89.22, down 192. And that's the livestock market conditions. Taxes on unhealthy foods containing large amounts of sugar and salt could be one of the trends coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic. David Hughes is a professor emeritus of food marketing at Imperial College in London, England. He says diabetes and high blood pressure are two pre-existing conditions which make COVID-19 and other diseases more serious or even deadly. For years, governments have been encouraging people to eat more healthy food, but Hughes says higher obesity rates show it hasn't worked.
Governments are saying, hang on, we've got to move on from nudging here. And actually, we have to go in with a big stick. Sometimes it's just, even by saying you're going to regulate, that you will push the food industry to do something that they should have done 5 years previously, like reduce sugar, for example, and not wait until they're threatened. I don't necessarily like it, but I would expect to see direct taxation on sugar, on salt, on areas where there are, you can actually count the health costs. We just can't afford it. We can't just say, please, could you eat a little healthier? We've got to do more than that. And I think you're going to see that writ large.
Large multinational food companies such as Nestle, Unilever, and General Mills are getting the message and have been introducing more plant-based food products. Hughes says about 20% of consumers can be termed as eco-active, and the number is growing.
They will change their purchasing behavior to buy the more eco-friendly products. 40% of people are still eco-dismissers, but that's going down. Eco-actives are going up. What's more, I would expect to see in the next 2 years that the market will force for all food products, I would suggest, to have an Enviro score on front of pack. It's already happening. Here's Oatly, oat milk, if you will, where they'll put the carbon impact on the front.
The leading edge of this trend is in Europe, and more specifically, the Scandinavian countries.
There's a supermarket in Sweden where the goods are priced on the basis of their carbon emissions. And I'm saying to everybody in the food industry, look at your product and work out what your Enviro score is going to be. And will that be helpful? Will that be positive? Or will that be a challenge for you? It's already happening in the US, Panera Bread and Chipotle, which are sort of fast casual dining places when they're opening, already in the menus, they have the carbon count.
Hughes says eating is becoming more complex because there are social pressures dictating choice.
Remind me again what we can't eat. Anything with palm oil as an ingredient, because what about the orangutans in Borneo? Chicken and eggs fed soy from Brazil, fish that isn't sustainably sourced, any meat or milk with hormones and antibiotics, food produced with slave labor, crops that are grown with too much water, eggs produced by hens in cages, beef that's destroyed the Amazon, anything in a non-recyclable pack. And so post-COVID in particular, you've got to look at what are the major social issues which will disturb growth in my food and drink markets.
And it appears the push to plant-based food is also extending into other products.
This sort of amused me to see Reebok, and what have they got? They've got a plant-based sneaker coming out soon. And what's more, it's pushed by who by? It's pushed by the wonderful Formula One driver, Hamilton. He's a great sports person. But also has the attention of many young people, and he's a vegan, and what's more, so is his dog. I always feel sorry for, there's his dog, Roscoe, his British bulldog, and Roscoe, I bet he doesn't like being a vegan, but that's another matter.
David Hughes is a professor emeritus of food marketing at Imperial College in London, England. He was the feature speaker Wednesday during the Farm and Food Care Winter Speaker Series. Please stay tuned. GX and Agriculture will return right after these messages.
Commodities Update.
Canola futures are trading down across the board this afternoon. May canola trading at $7.34.10, down $1.10. July canola trading at $7.03.40, down $1.50. May Minneapolis wheat trading at $6.38.75. That's down 11¾ of a cent. May Kansas City wheat trading at $6.34 per bushel, down 18½ cents. May Chicago wheat trading at $6.50¼, down 15½ cents. May corn trading at $5.44¾, down 5 cents. May soybeans trading at $14.25. That's down 7¼ cents. May oats trading at $3.63¾. That's up 2¼ cents. And that's the commodities update. The vice president of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute says after 1 month in office, Canada-U.S. relations under the Joe Biden administration have seen a return to the regular order. The Joe Biden administration is now just over 1 month into its mandate. Colin Robertson is the vice president and a fellow of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute.
Well, I don't see any discernible change at this point. I think that it's basically business as normal as it can be in COVID times. But the truck traffic that is carrying most of certainly agricultural produce back and forth is still proceeding both sides of the border. That is carrying American food products into Canada and any Canadian food products into the United States. And so that's good news. And I'm not aware, or at least I've not been read of any problems, particularly as it applies to agri-food.
Is the Biden administration considering entering the Trans-Pacific Partnership now?
Well, the pork producers would obviously like to get preferred access into the Pacific market. Of course, as you know, Canada is already a member of the CPTPP. This was the original Trans-Pacific Partnership was an Obama administration initiative that Canada and Mexico later came on to, but it was something that Mr. Trump withdrew from after the agreement had been negotiated. He subsequently negotiated a freer trade arrangement that provided access for some agricultural goods with Japan, which of course is the biggest market within the TPP. But in terms of the Biden administration, there's no word yet as to their intentions towards the Trans-Pacific Partnership. My sense is that the first focus is going to be on domestic recovery from COVID, and the trade policy will be something they look at probably into year 3 or 4. So much will depend on the midterms and what happens there if the Democrats remain in control of the House of Representatives and sustain their majority in the Senate. So I wouldn't look for progress. I think it is something that the Biden administration would like to do for geostrategic reasons, as much as what the access it will give, as you point out, pork producers and other American agricultural interests who would like to get access, preferred access that Canada enjoys, Australia enjoys, that Mexico enjoys, into that group of countries. And I think it will happen, but I don't think it's going to happen right away. I think that it's low on the list of the Biden administration priorities, and before they do that, I suspect they'll do an interagency review and just do their calculations. I think they would lean that way, again, for geostrategic reasons, as a counter to China. China, of course, has moved and is a member of one of the newest plurilateral trade agreements, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP.
What would be the implications for Canada if the United States does join TPP?
Well, we essentially have, there would not be many implications because we have, in our revised NAFTA, or the new Canada-US-Mexico Agreement, or USMCA as it's called in the United States, United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, we basically took the TPP template and used it to update the NAFTA and gave it a new name. So from a Canadian perspective, it would simply bring the United States into this broader Trans-Pacific trading partnership of which we are already a member. But in terms of the improvements that the U.S. wanted to make to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, they were sustained with a few exceptions relating to intellectual property. And I don't know whether the Biden administration would be as inclined to push it as would have been the Trump administration if they'd stayed in, because those in Congress, I think, are more inclined now to think that, especially post-COVID, that pharmaceutical drugs should be provided at fair cost to consumers, rather than to ensure what the creators would call would be a fair return to them. It's always a balance, and I think that the balance has shifted now from the creator side to the consumer side, notwithstanding the superb work that was done in creating the drugs that are now going to deal with COVID.
Just how has the COVID-19 situation impacted U.S.-Canada relations overall?
Well, what it has done most visibly is reduce the flow of the border, where we used to have 400,000 people a day cross. That's now in the tens of thousands. And there's no tourist traffic, and I think it's going to be some time before we can agree on the protocols, although that'll be one of the things that the Prime Minister and the President will talk about going forward. And I suspect that initially there'll be a series of pilot projects, and I think that we're going to probably introduce, in addition to the long-standing trade screen that's been there on trade between Canada and the United States, after 9/11, as you know, we introduced a security screen. I think we'll now introduce a health screen, and that may involve that anybody who crosses the border will have to show proof of either having had COVID or having been inoculated against it.
Overall, how has the change in U.S. administration affected relations?
Well, I think it's a restoration to the regular order that we enjoyed with U.S. presidents until Donald Trump. Donald Trump really was singular, and as you know, his policy was one of America first, and he seemed to give the back of his hand to the allies, including Canada, whereas Mr. Biden comes very much from that tradition of, as he has stated, that America's back and that America places great value on the alliance and America wants to lead the alliance. That was not Mr. Trump's approach. So Mr. Trudeau made the first call to congratulate Mr. Biden on his election, and Mr. Biden made the first call in response to congratulations to Mr. Trudeau, and then his first substantive call was with Mr. Trudeau, and now his first substantive business call with cabinet members is with Mr. Trudeau and his cabinet. So the relationship is certainly starting on a very promising level in comparison to how it had started with Donald Trump.
And is there anything you would like to add?
No, I think that's good. We'll have a better sense in the next week. I think they're going to come up with a what they call a roadmap as to where we go forward. And that roadmap will include things, I think, like Build Back Better Together for the middle class, a common approach towards climate, perhaps border adjustment tax, carbon pricing. There's a lot that the two governments share in common, social justice. And I think that those would be the kinds of things that we'll be talking about in the coming months, with follow-up by the responsible cabinet officers and then more regular meetings between the President and the Prime Minister.
Colin Robertson is the Vice President and a Fellow of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute. It's now 12:58 on GX and Agriculture, and let's check in once again with Danny Ismond.
And we're in Willabunch, the Willabunch Golf Club Auto Lotto, entering the final stages here, the final hours, the final tickets, all of it coming.
Welcome back. It's now 1 o'clock and time to check the GX94 Precision Weather Forecast. For the Quill Lakes, Hudson Bay, Swan River, Broadview, Mooseman, Indian Head, and Yorkton, Melville, Roblin, Russell regions today, cloudy with a 30% chance of scattered flurries, winds north-northeast at 15 to 30, and the temperature falling to minus 12. For tonight, cloudy with a 50% chance of flurries, 2 centimeters possible, Winds north-northeast at 15 to 25, a low of minus 21, a wind chill of minus 34. For tomorrow, cloudy with a 50% chance of flurries, winds south at 10 to 20, a high of minus 16. For Sunday, a 60% chance of scattered flurries, winds north-northwest at 10 to 20, a high of minus 11. For Monday, partly sunny, a high of minus 2. Tuesday, sunny, a high of plus 2. In the Paw, it's minus 23 degrees, Swan River minus 17, Dauphin minus 10, Brandon 0, Shoal Lake, Russell, Roblin, and Regina all in at minus 3. Saskatoon minus 11, Hudson Bay minus 18, Broadview, Mooseman minus 1, Indian Head minus 2, Wynyard, Wadena, Kelvington minus 12. The Yorkton-Melville region has some very light snow in the area, a north wind at 21 kilometers an hour. 81% is the relative humidity. The temperature is minus 6 degrees. With the wind chill, it feels more like minus 12 degrees. That's your agriculture weather, and that'll do it for GX on Agriculture for today. Be sure to tune in again on Monday at 12:15 for another edition of the program. It's time now for the news and sports headlines.
CJGX, a Harvard radio station serving Saskatchewan and Manitoba. We are GX94.